Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from the Lancet Regional Health Europe. It's April 2024 and I'm Daniela Marin, Deputy Editor of the Lancet Regional Health Europe. This month, I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Gabriel Otterman, Senior Consultant Pediatrician and Senior Lecturer at the Barnafrid National Center on Violence Against Children at Linköping University in Sweden, and Dr. Jordan Greenbaum, Medical Director of the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children, whose new systematic review and critical appraisal of European guidelines on clinical care for child sexual abuse was published in our April issue. Thank you very much, Dr. Otterman and Dr. Greenbaum, for joining us for this episode.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting us.
And I'm very happy to be here too. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, before we start discussing your article, I think it would be very helpful to have a clear understanding of what child maltreatment is and whether there is a specific definition for it.
Child maltreatment is a complex and multidimensional issue, broadly defined as any act or set of acts of commission or omission by a parent or other caregiver that results in harm, potential for harm, or threat of harm to a person under the age of 18. It encompasses physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, as well as neglect and exploitation. This broad definition doesn't always capture the nuances necessary for systematic data collection and analysis, which is critical for the development of effective intervention strategies. So allow me to say a word about the research team that produced this work. Our team is part of the Cost Action Multisectoral Responses to Child Abuse and Neglect in Europe, or EUROCAN. COST, which stands for European Corporations in Science and Technology, is an EU-funded program that enables researchers to set up their interdisciplinary research networks in the European region. So EUROCAN is a collaborative network today representing researchers and professionals across 35 countries that aim to advance knowledge and develop innovative strategies for the understanding, assessment, and prevention of child abuse and neglect across Europe. To address the challenges of defining child maltreatment for the purposes of data collection and surveillance, we're currently conducting an eDelphi study among experts within the 35 countries of the network. This study aims to develop a consensus in the field on a set of clear operational definitions of child maltreatment. The goal is to standardize the way we collect and report data across Europe, ensuring that when we talk about child maltreatment, we're all speaking the same language, which is crucial for cross-national research and ultimately for identifying evidence-based interventions for child protection. From a clinical standpoint, while the scholarly definition of child maltreatment is multifaceted and maybe nuanced, the concerns for abuse and neglect when a child or adolescent presents for care are often straightforward. Clinicians understand the profound implications it can have on a child's health and development. It is the subsequent response by frontline clinicians where we observe significant variability. This variability can be due to a range of factors such as differences in training, resources, institutional protocols, and even personal comfort levels in handling such sensitive cases. This unwanted variability in response can lead to inconsistencies in the care and support provided to the child and their family, and can result in children not receiving the level of care they need and deserve.
Okay, so I suppose that these difficulties with the definition make it rather problematic to have statistics on child maltreatment, but I would like to know if there is any information on the prevalence of child sexual abuse in Europe. And I am only asking about this type of child maltreatment because the article focuses on this specific type.
Yes, there have been a number of studies. In a 2011 global meta-analysis of child sexual abuse prevalence, the combined rates in Europe were 13.5% for girls and about 5.6% for boys. Now, keep in mind, this is just an estimate, and all prevalence estimates are difficult given the high rates of underreporting of child sexual abuse.
This percentage of 5 to 13% is shocking. This means that 1 in 10 children is sexually abused in Europe. And how does this affect children in the short and long term?
Yes, stunning figures indeed. Understanding child sexual abuse as a significant public health burden is crucial for a number of reasons. It highlights the need for effective prevention strategies, early and accurate identification, comprehensive trauma-informed treatment approaches, and long-term support for survivors. It also emphasizes the importance of educating the public and professionals about the signs of abuse and the best practices for response and management. Regarding the effects, the short-term effects of child sexual abuse might include emotional and behavioral problems such as fear, guilt, shame, confusion, and anxiety, which can become chronic if the abuser still lives in the home. The effects can vary based on the response of the supportive parent and whether the child is protected from future abuse. Immediate injury from contact abuse, sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy are also possible short-term consequences. The long-term effects associated with child sexual abuse are negative impacts on various aspects of life, including the ability to form healthy relationships, maintain employment, and impact mental, emotional, and physical health. Adult survivors risk a range of physical health problems like cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, among others. Mental health issues such as depression, anxiety, personality disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, complex PTSD, and substance abuse can also arise in adult survivors of child sexual abuse. That's why it's so crucial to prevent sexual abuse, and when it occurs, to respond effectively and reliably to mitigate these known associated risks.
And is it challenging to identify and manage child sexual abuse from a healthcare perspective?
Yes, a lot of challenges exist, and I think it helps us to look at these challenges from the perspective of the healthcare provider as well as the level of the patients. In many cases, providers lack education and training on two things, child sexual abuse and the appropriate way to interact with victimized, traumatized children. In other cases, providers lack any clear guidelines, which is what we were getting at in the study. And they also may feel very profound discomfort with talking about this very sensitive topic. So that's another challenge that providers have. And then finally, I think many are unaware of available community resources and hesitate to talk about sexual abuse if they don't know what to provide as resources as follow-up. And then if you look at the patient and family level, challenges exist there too. There's a tremendous amount of shame and stigma associated with child sexual abuse, no matter what culture you're in. In some cases, the child doesn't realize they've been abused and they can't disclose something if they don't realize it's happening. Or they may fear disclosing abuse, fear talking about it, and their fears are based on a lot of different ideas. So it may be hard for providers to recognize vulnerable patients if those patients don't present with a known history of abuse.
The variation in managing child sexual abuse across Europe is indeed a significant challenge, both within and between countries. We see disparities on who conducts the examinations, whether it's a pediatrician, a forensic expert, gynecologist, or other healthcare professional. The settings for these exams can range from hospitals to specialized clinics, and the legislation and policies that dictate health professionals' collaboration with child protective services, police, and other agencies differ widely.
Okay, I think that given all that we have discussed, we can now move on to your article. Could you explain what was the objective and methodology you used for this study?
Yes, our study was prompted by a systematic review published by Dr. Flora Blangis and colleagues in 2021. That revealed significant shortcomings in the guidelines for diagnosing child physical abuse. Anticipating parallel issues in child sexual abuse guidelines, we set out to identify and assess the guidelines available within European healthcare. A preliminary search in Medline using terms specific to child sexual abuse clinical practice guidelines did not identify any comprehensive reviews of European guidelines on clinical management. This gap indicated a clear need for a detailed evaluation of the guidelines European physicians are using to ensure they're up to standards, leading us to the next phase of our research. The gap in the literature was concerning, given that the studies have pointed out the often inadequate readiness of healthcare professionals to address suspected child sexual abuse in terms of knowledge, skills, and confidence across Europe, accompanied by substantial variations in clinical management practices. While the World Health Organization had issued exhaustive guidelines for child sexual abuse care in 2017 and 2019, intended for a global audience, there was a lack of clarity regarding the dissemination and quality of corresponding national clinical practice guidelines issued by health agencies or academic societies in Europe. Our aim was to fill this knowledge gap by systematically identifying, reviewing, and critically appraising the national guidelines available within European countries. This would help us assess their completeness, quality, and consistency, and identify areas for improvement to ensure that all children who experience sexual abuse receive optimal care regardless of where they are in Europe. In our study, we conducted a systematic search across 6 international databases, as well as multiple sources of gray literature, including contact with subject matter experts in each of the 34 countries in our network. We focused on clinical practice guidelines issued by national health agencies or academic societies within the 34 countries of the Cost Action Network. Our research was restricted to national guidelines published over a 10-year period from January 2012 to November 2022. Our team consisted of subject matter experts and research methodologists who were responsible for the searching, screening, reviewing, and data extraction phases. Researchers working independently in pairs conducted data extraction. The eligible national clinical practice guidelines were then assessed for their completeness by comparing them with the WHO guidelines from 2017 and 2019, which served as a benchmark for our study. We extracted 101 bullet point items from the reference publications that we expected to find in any quality national guidelines. Researchers worked in pairs to scrutinize each of the identified documents to tally the presence or absence of these quality markers that covered a variety of domains. Then to appraise the quality and reporting of these guidelines, we used the Appraisal of Guidelines for Research and Evaluation, or AGREE2 instrument, which is an internationally recognized tool for the evaluation of guideline development processes. Through this approach, we aim to provide a clear and objective evaluation of the current state of child sexual abuse guidelines within the European region, identifying key areas where improvements are necessary to enhance the clinical management.
And what did you find in the systematic review and critical appraisal of the European guidelines?
We found 4 major findings. First of all, in 50% of eligible countries, no national guidelines were identified. Now, this could be for a number of reasons. It may be that there are no protocols, or that the practitioners in a given country rely on the WHO gold standard guidelines, or perhaps they have institutional or local guidelines, not at the national level. Or in some countries, there may be a law that any healthcare provider who suspects child sexual abuse needs to refer that patient to a central forensic medical institute for care. So the hospital may not feel the need to have a specific protocol. However, I would argue that even in those instances, a hospital following a national guideline would be helpful so that the staff could recognize risk factors and indicators and know exactly what to do. The second and third findings in our study are interrelated. We found considerable variation in the content of the national guidelines within and across countries. And we also found that the guidelines lack many of the components that are typically included in state-of-the-art clinical practice. When compared to the WHO guidelines, the national guidelines differed across all 11 domains of standards. but were particularly marked for pregnancy and infection management domains. Now, there are several possible explanations, again, for this. The scope, the purpose, the target audience, and the settings of the national guidelines varied tremendously between one another. Some authors aimed to create very general guidelines limited to sort of high-altitude summary guidance, while others provided very detailed recommendations. Some guidelines directed healthcare professionals to specific national or international guidelines for specific things like HIV management or STI testing and treatment, rather than including it in their specific national guideline. And others lacked a discussion of specific aftercare options, including mental health care, which is a very important component of the child sexual abuse workup. One of the least commonly included bullets in national guidelines included healthcare professionals' beliefs and potential biases. Most of the guidelines did not admonish healthcare professionals to, quote, take care not to allow relationships with other family members to interfere with the ability to consider maltreatment, which is straight out of the WHO guidelines, or, quote, address healthcare providers' beliefs and values that can adversely affect their reporting practices. So those are two WHO recommendations. And it may be that preconceived notions about gender roles, including victimization of boys, and ethnic, racial, and socioeconomic biases may preclude recognition of vulnerable children or lead to victim blaming rather than victim serving responses. So we felt that this was a very important finding. Analysis of the WHO bullets most cited in the GLAAD guidelines revealed a strong representation of trauma-informed, rights-based principles for patient interaction. And we were very glad of this. This is important because while quantitative validation of the trauma-informed approach is fairly limited, qualitative studies of survivors of sexual violence consistently demonstrate the power and the use of a trauma-informed approach. So it was very helpful and encouraging to find that in so many national guidelines. The fourth finding was that the quality appraisal we conducted revealed very severe shortcomings in the development and strategic implementation of guidelines. The national guidelines scored relatively low in the quality assessment domain of scientific rigor. And we know a solid evidence base for clinical guidelines is absolutely critical and requires that kind of scientific rigor. And there may be a number of reasons for this lack. The process is certainly time and labor intensive, and it requires financial and human resources that really are may not be available to all work groups working on national guidelines. Governmental priorities may preclude inadequate funding. Or it's possible that some or all of the activities were completed, and they did scientific rigorous work, but they didn't document it in the guideline description. The quality appraisal also revealed low scores on stakeholder involvement. Now, we know that evidence-based medicine incorporates patient values and needs, and these are best determined by survivor involvement in guidance production. In the field of child protection, increasing emphasis is being placed on the importance of getting input from survivors and individuals with lived experience, as well as representatives of a range of professions involved with recognizing and responding to child sexual abuse. Unfortunately, this is not reflected in our comparison of national guidelines on stakeholder involvement. The low score on the applicability domain is notable, but not all that surprising. The criteria for this domain addresses activities related to NCPG implementation and evaluation. It's critical for guideline implementation to be organized, widespread, and accompanied by systematic monitoring for fidelity and use. I just want to mention a couple of the limitations that I think it's important to take note of for this study. One is that it's certainly possible we didn't identify some national guidelines. We did what we thought was a very rigorous systematic review, but we may have missed some. And in some countries, as I mentioned, healthcare is organized at the state, the provincial, or municipal level. So we may have missed guidelines used in practice that are not at the national level. And some countries may simply rely on the WHO guidelines and may have no formally recognized in clinical guideline. Another limitation it's important to make note of is that the nature of our scoring was fairly subjective. when we evaluate whether a given bullet in the WHO gold standard was present in the national guidelines or not present, we used a very crude three-option model, present, partially present, or absent, knowing that this is fairly crude, but making it crude because we knew that there was going to be a fair amount of subjective variation. We addressed the subjective nature of this scoring by making sure that each pair of reviewers came to a consensus on the score of each bullet. So they fully discussed them. And that's how we addressed that shortcoming. And finally, some of the guidelines were in non-English languages. So fine points may have been missed in translation, but we minimized the impact of this possible limitation by assigning reviewers in our very large group to guidelines that were in their native language whenever possible.
And what would be your recommendations to overcome the lack of national clinical practice guidelines or the variation in content across countries?
So in addressing the deficiencies that were revealed by our study that Jordan has explained, our recommendations are focusing on creating a framework that could be adopted universally, encouraging best practices that are evidence-based and child-centered. This framework aims to promote consistency in the response to child sexual abuse, assuring that all children receive the highest standards of care and the findings are accurately reported and utilized regardless of where in Europe the child is being seen. Unwanted variability or noise in the complex systems responsible for responding to child abuse can significantly impact the quality of care that children and adolescents receive. When protocols, training, and resources differ from one place to another, or even from one professional to another, the care can become fragmented and inconsistent, which is particularly problematic in the sensitive context of child abuse. Such variability can lead to several issues: inadequate identification of abuse, delayed or incorrect treatment, and potentially even additional trauma for the child. It can also result in a lack of proper support for the child's psychosocial needs, which is critical for their long-term and mental and physical health. Our goal is to minimize this noise by advocating for standardized, evidence-based guidelines that can be implemented across Europe. We want to ensure that all children and adolescents who experience abuse receive optimal care, care that is consistent, trauma-informed, and tailored to their unique needs. The establishment of comprehensive pan-European guidelines would provide a consistent framework upon which healthcare professionals can depend, ensuring that the care for child abuse is not only effective, but also delivered with empathy and equity. Our goal is straightforward: to reduce variability, to improve health outcomes, and to alleviate suffering for every child in every part of the European region.
Well, I think we can end the episode with this message. Thank you very much again for this conversation about child maltreatment and for sharing with us the findings of your study. You can read the article by Dr. Otterman and colleagues online at thelancet.com. Thank you, Dr. Otterman, and thank you, Dr. Greenbaum, and thank you for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With from the Lancet Regional Health Europe wherever you regularly listen to your podcast.